Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com. Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santikos studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Ransomware is a program that corrupts a computer and denies the user access to their files. The user then has to pay a ransom to regain those files unless someone, like a member of the ransomware hunting team, steps in and saves the day, if they can. This is the story of a band of misfit code breakers. It's told in the book, The Ransomware Hunting Team, and we're joined by the two co-authors, Renee Dudley, tech reporter at ProPublica. Renee, welcome to The Source.
Thanks.
Also with us is Daniel Golden, another co-author. He's a Boston-based senior editor and reporter at ProPublica. Daniel, welcome to The Source.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations, both of you. This book is really readable. I really enjoyed reading it. It's on top of all the great information inside. It was a compelling story with great characters, and I couldn't wait to find out what happens next. Particularly, I'm wondering next if my computer is going to get hacked or one of the ones I need at work. So, but Daniel Golden, you tell a story about a city, Baltimore. That's kind of like the worst case scenario, or there's a lot of worst case scenarios in the book, but talk about what happened there.
Yes, what happened in Baltimore was in 2019, just as a new mayor was about to be inaugurated, there was a ransomware attack that shut down a lot of city services in private business, too. People couldn't buy homes because the city couldn't provide the backup documentation necessary. A lot of city projects had to be stopped. Water bills could not be sent or paid, other utility bills. And it really threw the city into confusion. And the mayor then faced the question which people used to face in the days of traditional kidnap, and they face again with ransomware, which is to pay or not to pay. Because if you pay the ransom, the hackers will send you the key that can get your files up and running, but you're contributing money to criminals who may be affiliated with terrorism or with hostile governments, and you're encouraging more ransomware. But if you don't pay, it can take weeks or months to recover. And the ransom demand then was modest by today's standards, because they go up every year. It was only about $75,000, but the mayor refused to pay quite bravely, and it took months and months for the city to recover services. And ultimately, the city had to spend about $18 million to recover. So it was economically, it was not a good decision, but policy-wise, it was a brave thing to do.
And when the mayor ran for re-election, Daniel, what happened?
Well, he got 6% of the vote. There were a variety of reasons, but certainly one of them was that the ransomware attack had really delayed and stalled and prevented a lot of things that he was trying to do. And it got a lot of people in the city upset, both in the business community and just ordinary residents.
Renee Dudley, y'all write that the mayor had like this crisis, like, why me? Why did this happen to me while I'm mayor? You know, why couldn't it happen to the other guy? But you also say that when people get hit with a ransomware attack, that they go through the stages very commonly associated with the stages of grief. Can you tell us more?
That's exactly right. And it was one of the members of the hunting team, Fabian Wosar, who came up with this analogy. So to put yourself in a victim's shoes, you go log on to your computer. The screen might have a ransom note on it. And that note tells you can't open anything unless you pay a ransom. All of your files are locked. You can't open them. Your pictures, your important documents, everything is not accessible to you. What do you feel? You might feel shock. You might feel denial. This isn't happening to me. And then when you do some research, you might eventually come to acceptance. I have to deal with this. This is happening. And Fabian, the team member, compares it to the stages of of grief. And eventually, when people come to acceptance, they look at their choices. And if you're smart enough to have had good, robust working backups, you might be able to restore your files from those saved backups. If you're not so lucky, you might have to pay a hacker to get those files back. Unless, of course, the ransomware hunting team has cracked the strain of ransomware that's afflicted you.
So here in San Antonio, we have a local company called Rackspace. They started out as web hosting, and now they're kind of a cloud computing company. And they were hit in December, and it was a really big, horrible thing to happen to this company. And they're still trying to figure out how to dig themselves out of this. And if this company, which this is their job to protect their customers from these types of attacks, they were hit with what they call a zero-day attack, which is a very basic a root program that was installed at the very beginning of the writing of the code. What are people supposed to think about how vulnerable they are, Daniel?
Well, it's interesting how a lot of the ransomware attacks hit the places where you think they would be the most protected. For example, there have been a lot of police departments around the country that have been hit by ransomware, a lot of government agencies, and as you say, a number of information security companies. And I think that, cybersecurity is a very difficult thing to make perfect, right? Because employees will click on an email that seems entirely innocent, and it ushers in the ransomware. Or, because we have a very connected world, the attack may not be directly on the company. It may be on a client, a customer, a partner, and the ransomware gets in that way. So it's very hard to be 100% secure. Now, one of the things we find is that the places that are often hit are nonprofits that don't have quite the cybersecurity budget that a major corporation would have. So, for example, hospitals, universities, school districts, cybersecurity may not be as big a priority for them. They may have more pressing needs, and so they're kind of easy prey, and you'll see a lot of attacks on nonprofits.
Are they going after them directly, Renee? Is there spray and pray? I've heard that expression before, where they just send out emails and see who bites.
Well, it's evolved. When ransomware was starting out about a decade ago, you saw a lot of this spray and pray. Hackers would indiscriminately send out spam email, hoping that people would, home users mostly, would click on a bad link or open a spam attachment, which would unleash the ransomware into their systems. And at that point, the ransoms were a few hundred dollars, which, if you do enough of them, really adds up. But at a certain point around 2018, the hackers realized if they became more targeted and they went after victims with deeper pockets, they could accomplish a lot more by hitting one victim than they could by hitting 100 victims.
Right, like the Colonial Pipeline.
Really?
The Colonial Pipeline, which in the end cost, $4 million. We're going to talk about how big that was, how that happened, why that may have been a watershed moment for trying to start taking ransomware seriously. And also, we're going to find out more about the ransomware hunting team. And we're going to take your calls and emails. The number is 833-877-8255-833-TPR-TALK. You can tweet at us at TPRSource. Send an email to thesource@tpr.org. Have you ever been hit by a ransomware attack? And what did you do? What did you learn from that experience? And what are you doing to prevent it from happening to you or your business? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're going to be back after a one-minute break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book, The Ransomware Hunting Team, a band of misfits, improbable crusade to save the world from cybercrime. We're joined by the co-authors, Renee Dudley, Daniel Golden. They're both with ProPublica. Renee's a tech reporter there, and Daniel is the Boston-based senior editor and reporter at ProPublica. We welcome your phone calls. If you've got a question, a comment, if you've been hit by ransomware, you know, how'd that go down? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So what happened, Daniel, to this Colonial Pipeline?
Well, the Colonial Pipeline is one of the biggest pipelines in the country. I think it's more than 5,000 miles long from the southwest all the way up to the Atlantic coast. And it was hit by ransomware. I think the group was called DarkSide. It got in through some outdated part of the network that only had a single password protecting it, started freezing the systems, and they shut down the whole pipeline, which made national news because it essentially greatly reduced the supply of gas and gasoline products to the air, to the whole coast, and a lot of gas stations shut down. There was pretty widespread panic, and because of it, it was kind of a watershed. It was the probably the most publicized ransomware attack to date. I think it was in 2021, and so after that, the government started taking things more seriously. What happened there was they could not. Colonial could not fix the problem. They couldn't find the key, and so they had to pay a ransom of $4 million plus, and you know, which so often that doesn't become public, but in this case it did because it's such a big story, and the CEO testified. And so this, the whole Colonial case drew so much attention that it led the FBI director to liken ransomware to 9/11 in terms of a threat. And it really made the U.S. government, which had kind of not paid adequate attention to ransomware, finally and belatedly wake up to the risk it was running.
And so they attacked the ability to bill and track billing for the pipeline. The pipeline worked fine. They just couldn't charge money for the gasoline they were moving around, and they're not going to give it away for free. So, Renee Dudley, that shows you that any part of the system is vulnerable. It doesn't have to be like critical to operations, but everything. And so is that causing corporations, nonprofits, cities, utilities to look at their systems and try and make them not so vulnerable?
Well, actually, it did shut down the flow of gasoline, and it caused so much panic. People were, were trying to, fill
Tupperware containers,
plastic bags with Tupperware containers, plastic bags with gas, and it did cause a huge crisis. But in terms of corporations, sure. This is long, cybersecurity has long been underestimated as a priority. Going back years, I remember talking to corporate board members. They couldn't get corporate information security executives. They couldn't get corporate board members to prioritize cybersecurity because, say you need $10 million to become more secure. I would hear that board members would tell them, listen, $10 million at the end of the year, we have nothing to show for it. And your CISO, your information security officer, would say, well, that's exactly the point. We don't want anything to show for it. We need to be investing to prevent these attacks from happening in the first place, but it just hasn't been a priority. And I think now people are really waking up to it, and we're seeing more of a priority on it than ever before.
So, Daniel Golden, now there's ransomware insurance. What does that do? Does everyone have that now?
Well, I don't think everybody has it, but there is cybersecurity insurance, and some of the policies speak to ransomware or this specific ransomware insurance. And there's been a lot of change in how the insurance industry has dealt with ransomware attacks. So a few years ago, when the demands were not quite as high, the insurers were a force for actually abetting the rise of ransomware, because many of the insurers would say to their clients that got hit, you know, we'll cover it because it's going to be, it's cheaper and more predictable, the amount, than the amount it will cost you to get your business back going. So, you know, if the ransomware demand is $100,000, but, you know, your business is going to take, you know, 6 months to come back, and you're going to lose a lot of clients, and who knows whether we'll ever be able to get everything up to snuff, it's safer to just pay the ransom. And so often insurance companies would pay the ransom. Now that the ransom demands are getting into the, you know, millions and tens of millions of dollars, the insurance companies are, you know, often much more reluctant to pay. And some of them have gotten out of the ransomware insurance business because it's just too expensive. So that, I don't think it's that easy to get ransomware insurance these days, often if you're a business. And if you do, they're probably much more reluctant to cover the payment than they used to be.
Renee, do you pay these guys with what? How do you do that?
Usually with Bitcoin. This is what has put ransomware on the map as a crime. You know, in the early days of ransomware, before the advent of Bitcoin, hackers were asking for prepaid cards and, you know, other ways that were were not traceable. But once Bitcoin came on the scene, it made that a lot easier for them. They feel confident that it's anonymous enough. Sometimes they even ask for even less traceable forms of cryptocurrency, Dash and Monero and things like that. There's been a slew of businesses that have popped up around the U.S. that actually specialize in transacting ransom payments, because a lot of victims don't exactly know how to obtain and transact Bitcoin. So these negotiators and transaction agencies have created a business model of doing that for them. And they range in how above board they are. Some of these agencies negotiate with hackers without even telling the victims they're doing that. And they say they have their own proprietary ways of solving the ransomware without having to pay hackers, and essentially misleading the victims, paying the hackers without telling the victim.
So, Daniel, can we shut down? I mean, I guess you can't shut down Bitcoin or these other cryptocurrencies, but making them less fungible, making them harder to transfer into, so you can buy anything with it. Is that a solution?
I'm not as familiar with exactly what you would do with cryptocurrencies to fix it. I mean, I think that anything that makes the use of them harder is probably beneficial, but not easy to do, particularly in an international situation. There's a variety of reform proposals.
So who are these guys who are doing the ransomware? And we've heard that they're no longer little mom and pop shops. They now have like corporate style organizations, and they could even be called state sponsored terrorism at times, Daniel.
Yeah, that's right. The hackers, the ransomware attackers tend to be not in the U.S., but from overseas in countries like Russia, Iran, other Middle Eastern countries and Eastern European countries, North Korea, places that often we don't have an extradition agreement with. So even if we get the evidence to indict them, we can't arrest them and bring them to trial. And yes, in earlier days, it was often a lone individual operation. Now, increasingly, they're organized into larger hierarchies that almost kind of mirror legitimate business, you know, with the specialized people doing a variety of tasks. And they also have affiliates around the world who they sometimes work with, who will identify potential targets for them. So it is increasingly a sort of form of organized cybercrime. And the people in it are, interestingly, they're not that different in their interests are in a way than the ransomware hunting team that we write about. And often there's contact between the two sides. You know, the ransomware hunting team are you know, people relatively young. They enjoy video games. They're kind of tech nerds. And so are a lot of the attackers. So that they, you know, one side decided to use their technical ability to be greedy and make an awful lot of money. And the other side decided to save people for free and kind of be a salvation for society. But yet they have a lot of the same technical abilities and a sort of a lot of the same hobbies and pastimes.
Renee, you would write that they sometimes would taunt each other, or that the ransomware guys in their code, they would taunt the ransomware hunting team.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it sort of unnerved some of the members of the team. One I'm particularly thinking of right now is Fabian Wosar. This is somebody who was extremely paranoid about his work and the hackers coming after him. Because you have to remember that when the ransomware hunting team members crack a ransomware, they're not just harming the hacker's income stream, but because some of these hackers are, you know, have increasingly, there's evidence that they're tied to foreign governments, Russia, Iran, North Korea. He started to worry, you know, this could be the start of something really bad. I don't need Putin coming after me or his henchmen. And so at one point, hackers wrote in the code of their ransomware, you know, F Wosar, you know, come crack me. You know, we know that you're looking at us. And he felt that it was a direct threat. At another point, they said, we're going to send our friends over to Hamburg. You know, that's where he'd listed, he's German, and he'd listed that on his LinkedIn profile as his location. And he got really worried. And so much so that he ultimately relocated to the UK because of its stricter privacy laws. But this banter is characteristic of their relationship over the years. And at a certain point, Fabian turned this banter and this, you know, this sort of relationship that he built up with a lot of the hackers to his advantage. He opened a secure messaging service, and he invited hackers to write to him. You know, if you are thinking of getting out of the business, write to me, and you know, you can unload your keys for victims on me, and let your conscience feel more free. And believe it or not, they actually did that. Oftentimes, it was hackers would seek revenge on their enemies and try to undermine their underworld enemies, ransomware businesses, and their competitors, but Fabian didn't mind that because it was in the name of helping more victims.
And so, Daniel, it sounds like these two groups had a tip of the hat sort of respect for each other.
Yeah, it's a little bit of respect from the hackers toward the hunting team, and the hunting team return a little bit of respect, maybe a little bit of disdain, but yet appreciation for some of the ability. I mean, but I think it depends on which hacker you're talking about, because some of them don't have a lot of technical ability compared to the hunting team. And so the members of the hunting team will be like, oh, we can crack this. This guy's, you know, doesn't know what he's doing. He made a bunch of mistakes. And then others have kind of foolproof code that they can't crack. And that's where they have the respect. So it sort of depends on the level of technical expertise. I mean, and these hunting team guys, you know, this is their world, the internet. I mean, a lot of them have never even met each other in person, you know, so they're always on there and trading, you know, ideas and witticisms or playing games. And it's a world where they're in contact with everybody to do with ransomware over various platforms, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's insurance, whether it's the hackers, whether it's the victims, or whether it's the other hunting team members.
When we come back from the break, I'm going to talk about Michael Gillespie. He's one of the people that you profile quite a bit in the book, and he seems just like a guy, like, you know, an ordinary people who can do extraordinary things. We're going to talk about him and his ability and his desire and what he's given up to help people who've been victimized by ransomware. If you've got a question or a comment, call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're going to be back after this two-minute break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're discussing the book, The Ransomware Hunting Team, a band of misfits' improbable crusade to save the world from cybercrime. We're joined by the two co-authors, Renee Dudley, Daniel Golden, and we welcome your phone calls. If you have a question, a comment, if you've been hit by a ransomware attack, the number is 833-877-8255. And so, Renee Dudley, tell me about Michael Gillespie. How did you get to meet him? And is that what set off, like, this is a book?
Yeah, it is. So I started reporting on ransomware in 2018 for ProPublica. And very early on in the reporting, people started telling me that I needed to reach out to a man that they only knew as DemonSlay335. That's his Twitter handle and the way that victims reached him. And I did. I eventually found out his name was Michael Gillespie and tracked him down to his work, which was a Nerds on Call IT repair shop in the town of Normal, Illinois. And we got talking, and he was extremely helpful in elucidating ransomware for me and explaining very technical things in a very accessible way, very humble. He was instrumental in helping us prove how some of these negotiation firms were scamming victims. And I just kept up the conversation with him as the months went by and our stories on ransomware started publishing. And at a certain point, decided to visit him on his home turf in Illinois. And I got to his home, and I was really blown away by his circumstances, because at this point, I knew from talking to his collaborators that Michael is the world's foremost expert in ransomware. He cracks more of it than anybody else. He knows more about it than virtually anybody else, and he works on it all the time. Yet here he was greeting me from his porch swing in a working class neighborhood and a pretty run down home. He's got, you know, a handful, you know, six or seven cats that he'd adopted, a couple dogs, a rabbit. And he opens up his phone and he has dozens and dozens of notifications from victims just begging him for help to solve whatever ransomware had afflicted them. And I was really amazed that he was doing all of this for free. He doesn't get paid for his work in solving ransomware and helping all these victims. And he's doing it in any spare second that he has. At work, at home, deep into the night. And as we got to talk, he shared some of his personal struggles. He was having trouble paying his bills. One month he'd have to turn off water, the next month electric. He almost lost his home. He had to surrender his car. And he'd just overcome cancer. And his personal circumstances and his humility really stuck with me. And I called Dan, who was then my editor at ProPublica, and I called him from the airport in Bloomington, and I said, I think this guy is probably a good profile for us. And, ultimately, he became the star of our book.
He grew up low income. His wife also is kind of dovetails into this techie kind of world, but she complains that all of his cyber sleuthing slows down their bandwidth while she plays The Sims. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah, she's suffered some of the consequences of Michael's dedication to his craft, because, you know, when I tell you he did this morning, noon, and night, that's no exaggeration. he would he'd stay at the office late, helping victims that he'll never know crack their ransomware. If they were would be eating dinner, he might jump up in the middle of the meal and run to his computer if somebody needed urgent help. And she was left, she felt lonely and was dealing with depression through a lot of this. And Michael is one of a dozen members of this team, and a number of them suffered these kinds of personal consequences of dedication to this public service of helping people recover for free.
And Renee, you're right that there were times where he couldn't help people because the software was uncrackable and the ransomware. And so and people were saying, if you can't help me, I'm going to kill myself. He took that very personally.
He did. And I heard this from him and from Fabian. They would do just about anything they could to help people. But as you mentioned, when there's no flaws in the code, there's virtually nothing they can do. And when people would say things like that, they're already feeling in a vulnerable position from all of the consequences of their efforts. The personal sacrifices and the family sacrifices that they've made. So when victims would say something like that, it would just make make an already very vulnerable situation feel that much worse.
Daniel Golden, why is this happening with this group of good-intentioned, ransomware hunting team? Why isn't there a law enforcement agency? You all talk about how the Dutch are really good at this. Why don't we have something like that?
Well, you're right. I mean, the ransomware hunting team is really filling a void. I mean, they've helped several million victims save not to pay, billions of dollars in ransom. And they've done it without a lot of governmental support or governmental involvement. I mean, the FBI and the Secret Service are the main, U.S. institutions sort of that would normally, look into cybercrime. And the FBI, it's never really been their sweet spot. They've been more into organized crime, drugs, terrorism. And also they've generally had this philosophy that any agent should be able to do any kind of case. And that works well in a lot of ways, but it doesn't work very well with the kind of specialized knowledge you need for cybercrime. And they do have some people who are sort of nicknamed dolphins, who are not full-fledged agents, but are computer people who help with investigations. But they don't have nearly enough of them or enough cyber agents. And so those people are overwhelmed and deluged. And for a long time, because ransomware was... the demands were relatively small, the FBI dismissed it. Oh, it's an ankle biter crime. It's only a few hundred bucks. It's not enough to interest us. And they were sort of taken unawares when the demands started just rocketing up and the targets became major corporations and institutions. And Secret Service has had some success, but, their primary role is protecting political candidates and their families. And so, somebody might get pulled off a cyber investigation at Secret Service for a body detail during an election campaign. So the U.S. government has really been lackluster on this. And then also, the other thing is the FBI is mostly interested in improving their effectiveness through arrests. And because, as I mentioned, the hackers are mostly in countries that we don't extradite from, it's very hard to get an arrest. And so that's probably another factor that has militated against really doing a good job on it, with the result that a lot of the cyber agents and cyber scientists get frustrated, disgusted, overwhelmed, and they leave. And that just creates an even worse problem.
How far does it have to go, Daniel, from a financial crime of ransomware to state-sponsored terrorism, where they're not asking for money to give you the key to unlock your computers so that the gas can flow or the water can flow? They just want to shut down utilities across America. We heard about a year ago, just before the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, that the United States don't get involved or else we're going to sick our cyber people on you. That didn't happen, but We have a lot, you know, that's a possibility.
Yeah, that's a very short step to cross for the variety of ways. I mean, you know, before and around the time of the Ukraine invasion, a number of Russia-based ransomware groups basically declared their support for the Putin regime and for the attack. And, you know, in a way, they could hardly do otherwise because and keep going in Russia because they exist there because the Putin regime has looked the other way. When there was, you know, a summit between Biden and Putin, I guess, in 2021, and Biden, at Biden's pressure, Putin, you know, agreed to crack down for a little while on the ransomware gags. But then I'm expecting, I think, maybe the U.S. would reciprocate by going easy on the Ukraine invasion. But when the U.S. did, you know, Putin went back to just letting the ransomware gangs do whatever they wanted, and in all likelihood, you know, using some of their talents for the Russian effort. The other thing is that what's happened in ransomware in recent years is instead of simply, you know, taking over the files and demanding a ransom, now before they do that, they go through the information that's in the files to see if there's anything that might be of use, you know, for potential blackmail. And one could easily see them snooping in there for national security secrets and handing that information over to a regime like the Russian regime.
Or like the Sony hack, where they released things like scripts and why some stars are treated the way they are. That's just another example of that. We're going to take a break here. We're going to continue our discussion about cybercrime, cybersecurity. The city of San Antonio has put cybersecurity as a hot topic, something that we're investing in. We want San Antonio to become a city for protecting the world from cybercrime. What does that look like? What's the future for that? Got a question or comment? Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're going to be back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book, The Ransomware Hunting Team, with the co-authors Renee Dudley, Daniel Golden. If you've got a question, give us a call, 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. Well, the city of San Antonio here is investing heavily in trying to become a hub for cybersecurity. We have local high school teams that compete very well and frequently win championships for cybersecurity. That's a thing. And also, we've just unveiled 2 weeks ago at UTSA, University of Texas San Antonio, a new building downtown, $98 million building for data sciences and cybersecurity. We have the Air Force here, which is also there. They have a branch that is dedicated to cybersecurity. A lot happening locally. Daniel Golden, is this where the future is? We have to invest in this area?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that cybersecurity advances are very important. I mean, the whole nature of crime, in a way, has changed, and ransomware is symbolic of that. I mean, if you think back before cybercrime, I mean, you know, most crime, other than, you know, civil cases and into criminal cases, you know, they occurred at a certain place where if law enforcement got there soon enough, you know, they could make an arrest at the scene. But now we're dealing with a much more complex and difficult kind of crime to investigate, you know, cybercrime, which is international. And so, you know, prevention is more important than ever, and sophisticated understanding is more important. So, yes, cybersecurity is very important. Now, that being said, you know, the cybersecurity industry, I mean, in a way, it may, you know, in some cases, it may profit more by having ransomware attacks happen and then coming in and trying to, you know, be paid to fix the damage rather than making ransomware go away.
Like the arsonist on the volunteer fire department.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, the cybersecurity companies, their interest may not be in ransomware disappearing because that takes away maybe their their reason to exist to some degree, but in having it be alive and well and then thwarting it or fixing the consequences of it. So, you know, there may be mixed motives, mixed profit motives when it comes to how effective the cybersecurity industry is in dealing with ransomware. That's why the fact that the ransomware hunting team is volunteer, you know, a group of about a dozen people around the world who, you know, they take no money for what they do. They're purely, their effort is purely to try and block ransomware. They're not sullied by the profit motive. But even there, it's complicated because when they crack ransomware and people don't pay the hackers anymore, sooner or later the hackers realize, hey, why isn't the money coming in? They realize they must have a mistake in their code and they fix it. So the quality of ransomware is actually, in a way, getting better because of the hunting team's activity in identifying the vulnerabilities.
So a Cold War one-upmanship, and that's why it gets more and more difficult. And so, Renee Dudley, is cyber, this technology, is it always for defensive purposes, or do we have, I've heard of Red Hat hackers who are actually on the offense, who are going after the ransomware and cyber criminals, that they try to turn the tables on them. I mean, is that happening?
Well, there's a few things going on there. One is, there's certainly ethical hackers. These are folks who will go into an organization, often paid by an organization, such a corporation, nonprofit, hospital, et cetera, to go into their systems and try to find vulnerabilities. And, the thought is, you want somebody on your team finding vulnerabilities before hackers do so that you can plug them. So that's going on. And then there's this notion of sort of hacking back, which at times the hunting team has actually done. They're willing to go great lengths to help victims. And sometimes that means finding vulnerabilities in the hacker's own servers and extracting keys that way, in sort of this ethical gray area. But again, with the victims, saving victims and getting their data back at the heart of it.
Daniel Golden, do we know if Putin's hacking team, have they launched their attacks and they were thwarted? Are they holding back, what do we know from that? Particularly now that we hear that he is he's yelling and threatening and stamping his feet because of tanks that could be coming from the West and to help Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know any more than what you or I would read in the news. I don't have a channel to Putin, but I would be very surprised if they aren't at the very least preparing something like that. And I think also probably Ukraine is also interested in what it can do with hacking. You know, they have very sophisticated operations themselves, so there may be a bit of a standoff there.
We mentioned that some people have lost their lives because of ransomware. Daniel, can you tell us more?
Yeah, there have been a number of cases. I mean, for example, there was a hospital in Alabama where it had been hit by a ransomware attack that essentially disabled the electronic machines and diagnostic equipment and so on. So when a woman was giving birth, because of the lack of this equipment, they didn't notice that the fetus was in distress, and the baby was born severely brain damaged and died soon after. So that's an example of a death linked to a ransomware attack. There's also been just an awful lot of heartrending stories of what happens when hospitals are hit. You know, there's a rural hospital in Oregon where I talked to the people there and some of the patients. And when it got hit by ransomware, one couple, the husband, he had, a brain tumor, and he was scheduled to undergo chemo and radiation. Instead, they're both elderly. His wife had to drive him a very long distance through ice and snow day after day through the mountains to the nearest hospital, some 90 or so miles away for the treatment. And, so what was already an ordeal became an even worse one. So, some of the attacks, on hospitals and clinics and other services, there's real human drama and tragedy in the aftermath.
So, Renee Dudley, have we figured out, have we assigned duties now? We know that protecting America from cyber attacks, is that the FBI's role, Department of Homeland Security, you know, who, the cyber force, who's in charge?
Well, they all should be, and they should all be taking a part, and increasingly they are taking a part. We write in the book, for years, ransomware has gone dismissed as an ankle-biter crime, and now, after the Colonial Pipeline attack, it was compared to the 9/11 terrorist attack, and now it's this huge priority. But the government is a little behind the curve now because we've had years of not putting enough resources to it. But we're beginning to see changes there. And one notable change is that the FBI is now cooperating more closely with private researchers who have some of the best information when it comes to attacks. They have information about who may be a sitting duck, and law enforcement can alert those folks in advance of an attack and thwart it.
People like Michael Gillespie, is he finally being brought on board as a consultant or something?
Well, he and the rest of the hunting team are working closer than ever with federal law enforcement. And one exciting thing that they're doing is that when they have a fix for victims, the FBI is able to tell people who report to them that this fix is available. And that's a big change, because in the past, the hunting team would have to alert victims quietly of these fixes. They can't go out and broadcast that they have a solution, because that also tips off the hackers, who would then go ahead and fix the vulnerabilities that they found. But people, victims go to federal law enforcement to report that they've been a victim of a crime, and when they do that now, there's something that law enforcement can actually give them potentially, which is the keys to the ransomware that's afflicted them.
So what do people need to know about protecting themselves from a ransomware attack, Daniel Golden?
Well, certainly they need to take all of the cybersecurity measures that are commonly talked about, two-factor authentication and the like, and backing up their files onto storage that may not be connected to the Internet, and those kinds of precautions. I think they also need to know of the existence of the hunting team and of some of its websites, so that, like ID Ransomware, for example, so that if they're hit by ransomware, they can go there and see if the strain of ransomware that has hit them is something that the hunting team has cracked, in which case they could get the key. So, without paying. And I think they also have to be knowledgeable consumers in terms of, if they've been hit by ransomware and they're looking on the Internet, who can help me? They don't get hoodwinked by some of the companies that Renee mentioned that might pretend to have a solution to crack the ransomware, but instead are really paying the ransom. So, I think people need to be sophisticated consumers in all those ways. And I think, hopefully our book will help by bringing the situation to light and making things more transparent. And I think transparency in general would be very helpful in this area.
And really quickly, Renee Dudley, is Michael doing better now?
He is. Yeah. He after the profile on ProPublica ran, he got a new job, and he and his wife have a new baby, and they're doing a lot better.
That's awesome. Renee Dudley, tech reporter at ProPublica, co-author of The Ransomware Hunting Team, A Band of Misfits' Improbable Crusade to Save the World from Cybercrime. Daniel Golden is a Boston-based senior editor and reporter at ProPublica, and also a co-author of the book. Very enjoyable read. Thank you both. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Dallas Williams and Megan Halbadier Moore, with production assistance provided by Mark Hutchison. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.